in the amalgamation of the different groups, the CSN had the monopoly of the auxiliary nurses, okay? The majority of the registered nurses are with an independent union. So they were, the CSN immediately lost 7,000 dues-paying auxiliary nurses like that, because the government went forward and passed a filibuster just before Christmas, and this is the law now. Also, since there's not that many jobs going on right now, just before that day, actually 2 days before, we heard that there was criminal accusations against the QFL construction union, because they had beat up, their full-timers had beat up a certain number of ordinary workers at two of major construction sites, one on the North Shore and another one in Gaspé, the Gaspésia construction site that has just been canceled, by the way. $350 million put in the factory, and they decided they just shut down the whole project. So there's considerable infighting right now over dues and control of work sites between the two major unions, which are the QFL and the CSN. So presently, even though we, like we said, best working class fighting day in the history of Quebec since 1972, at least in my opinion, and I think the numbers, and I think the partial picture I gave of the situation to you confers that this was a serious day of struggle, was just essentially permitted as a way of letting off steam. And of course, they've done nothing to follow up on it. They've said, we're going to fight this to the finish, which means that, for example, there's all kinds of commissions right now of the government going around Quebec to consult the population on, do you want to be more sick? Do you want to be more poor? Do you want to be more ignorant? It's some interesting questions like that. And what the unions have been doing is, at some point you'll get 10 full-timers with a few placards in front of the door, 12 at another place, 15 at another place. This is the fight to the finish. The other thing they've been doing is, the Quebec unions are traditionally linked to nationalist formations. So they've decided, in essence, to promote the Parti Québécois politicians, which were in government just last year. Okay. So that means, for example, that the leader of the opposition, Bernard Landry, is invited to speak at all the major rallies, and saying that he's presented as our speaker, our porte-parole, the in French, which means the person that carries our voices. Okay. What's very interesting is that, for example, the statistics I gave you on the $520 hike a day per child in daycare, we now know that before the Parti Québécois was beaten in March of last year, they intended to make the hike $1,200. Okay, so in government, their intentions were worse than the Parti Québécois. And right now, they've announced different demonstrations all around the anniversary of the election of the Liberal Party, saying that they had not voted for this, implying, of course, that the next time there would be another vote, not a vote in the sense of working class interest, but in the sense of getting their friends of the Parti Québécois back into the saddle. Okay, but again, it's being done in complete disparity. The teachers have voted the principle of a strike on the 14th of April. The other unions are saying that they'd be doing something in that period, but again, no call for a common front of any kind, even though Quebec is pretty much the province where the common front was pretty much invented in the 70s, and is somewhat of a tradition. Is this an exception? Okay, I talk about the preceding role of the Parti Québécois, and how, in effect, the unions are doing everything to separate, divide, atomize any form of effective reaction, strike action against these really dramatic cuts. It's it's almost like a bad a film we've been seeing on and on and on and on and on, a horror film for many years now. The Social Democratic Parti Québécois, in the preceding mandate, under Lucien Bouchard, this guy, a great friend of the working class, who started his career, by the way, as a boss's lawyer, and when I negotiated against him in 1982, he was the boss's lawyer, who said that all the workers in the public sector in Quebec have to accept a 20% direct wage cut, and he was paid $800 a day in 1982 money to talk about the need for sacrifice. So this friend sat down in an exercise that was called the Forum Social, and he proposed an anti-deficit law, okay? And all the unions, all the community groups, and all the bosses, and all the so-called intellectuals were around this huge table, something like about 140 representatives, our representatives. And Lucien Bouchard said, well, it's going to be hard. This is the same period where Harris was doing his junk here. But you never heard about it, I think. Essentially said, I need $1 billion right away. Okay? And there's no fucking around here. The only place where we can go and get it is education and health services. Welfare. So, because we have this huge national problem in Quebec with the debt, and we need everybody to participate in the national effort to get rid of it. So the unions knocked on the table and they said, we have to think about this. This is pretty much of a big step. And they asked that the works be stopped for 24 hours. When they came back 24 hours after, their joint declaration, unanimous declaration, okay, was that $1 billion cut in health, education, and welfare was unacceptable. What was needed was a $2 billion cut. This is not a joke. This is a historical facts. If you want us to send press clippings to, there's been books written about this in Quebec. This is what we consider, and I'll try to get now to the point of the meeting here tonight, is that even though there were heroic struggles in the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, to build mass defense organizations of workers, and that revolutionaries in that period were quite right, not only to support but to participate in those struggles in the union structures, that unions, and that under the ascending phase of capitalism, I don't want to use the progressive phase of capitalism, but the ascending phase of capitalism, where there were possibilities of getting real reform, getting the children out of the 9-year-old children out of their minds, getting the work week, for example, of the railway porter, which was the absolute record, was 7 days a week, 16 hours a day, getting those hours down, fighting for the historic 888. Eight hours of work, 8 hours of rest, 8 hours with your family and culture and movies, having a bit of fun, having a bit of sex maybe. All nice things. All nice things for all nice people. Even if that was possible. Today, in decadent capitalism, because that's how we identify the present phase of capitalism, decadent, dangerous, ugly, poisonous capitalism, these permanent or semi-permanent reforms are not possible anymore. And if we look at the world, it's not a question of the Liberal Party in Quebec right now. It's not a question of the Liberals being here or the Social Democrats in Germany with their Agenda 2010, which is proposing exactly the same goddamn cuts across the border. Governments calling themselves social democratic, liberal, greens, feminist, conservative, all have the same agenda, and the main tools that they are using to pass this agenda is the trade unions themselves. okay, they have become, in effect, a part of the planning apparatus of the ruling class. This is not to mean that individuals still believing in the unions locally are traitors. We're not saying this. This is not to mean that, for example, if the union calls a meeting in my factory, I shouldn't go to it. I should go to it. But it does mean that it's the revolutionary's task to acknowledge this fact that the essential part of this structure has gone over army bagage, arms and baggage, to the ruling class, and that we need to think of new forms of organization, self-activity, self-organization, calling on general assemblies. If there's a place where there's 20 unions, well, individual workers, caucuses of workers can call on an assembly of all the workers of that workplace, independently of union affiliation, etc. Things that were useful at the beginning have become paralyzing forces. For example, all the union trade. How much time do I have?
Depends how we want, how strict we want to be, but I'd say 5 or 10.
Okay, I won't go more than 5. We'll keep time for the discussion. The collective agreement, which is one of the major tools of a trade union, recognizes that for the length of the contract, and the contract tend to be longer and longer, by the way. For example, the Alcon, Arvida workers, they want to close down parts of the plant right now, and they're screwed. And those are the workers that actually occupied part of the plant and continued production without the bosses last month. They're screwed because they've got a 7-year contract. Okay? And even though the workers in the plant said, we're going to go out on strike, the union told them, well, if you're going out on strike, you're alone, fellows, and there's no strike fund for you. And we won't defend you if you're fired, okay? Because the collective agreement recognizes that for the length of a contract, the boss is the boss, okay? That you recognize management rights for the whole duration of the contract. The grievance, you know, I don't know, let's say the foreman doesn't like me because I'm a commie, and he's on my back all the time, and okay, I'm going to go and see my delegate, and I'm going to make a grievance. The whole grievance, in general, thing, is in the past, what used to happen was when a worker was individually attacked like that, well, there were things that were done more collectively. Like, everybody in the fucking department, we're going to have a slowdown to help out our friend here, and we're going to slow down the production until it's finished. Now, with the grievance method, it's 200 days on average per grievance that it takes to treat a case, costing, by the way, tens of thousands of dollars, okay? And the more you advance in the grievance process going up to arbitration, the less of your own fate is in your own hands. Even with collective grievances, the class struggle under the trade union regime has passed from the factory floor to the lawyer's office, to the Minister of Labor's functionary's office, to whichever fucking specialist of whatever fucking department's office, completely, and it's individualized. Divided once again the workers from the rest of their co-workers. The arbitration, of course, is of the same level. So, in effect, if we look at the role of the unions, and I know Neil has a good one for you a bit later, but if you look at, for example, the reports from the MEDEF, which is the Bosses Association of France, a very, very, very intelligent, documented bosses association. I don't think we have that level of refinement here. Our published documents where they say we're extremely worried. What's happening? All the French workers are leaving the unions. What's going to happen to us? With whom are we going to negotiate? Who's going to discipline the workers? who's going to remind them that they've accepted a certain numbers of conditions. The application of a contract may contain elements of progress for some workers sometimes, and not all the time, and less and less often, but in effect guarantees a business atmosphere permitting the extraction of the best possible exploitation rate that the boss can get out of the workers. We think that the unions have become, in essence, I'm sorry, I'm having a problem with my English tonight, a control operation for the bosses over the working class. And this is despite what even a certain level, a number of intermediary trade union leaders think of their own tasks. I used to be responsible for political action for that big union I was talking about, the CSN, okay, for many years on a provincial level. And at that time, I can tell you that I think I had a good heart and my intentions were pure, but over a period, I'm a hard-headed person, so it took me about 15 years to understand that every year I was helping in the general screwing of my fellow workers. And how can I give you examples of how this happens? For example, in 1982, in my home region of Abitibi, there was a women's strike that I worked on. And I was not the direct full-timer responsible. I was a political counselor to the strike. At some point, the women strikers came to see me. They said, Shah, we can't. We've been on strike for a fucking year. We're getting, besides you, we're getting very little support. There's never been any news of this strike outside of our little town. And the fucking full-timer who's responsible for our strike is getting on our nerves, and we can't meet without her bitching at us. So what do you think? Could we meet just the strikers together? You're not there, and that foolish full-timer is not there, and we decide what we want to do with our strike. Okay, and I foolishly accepted. I said, that seems fine to me. Well, that was the end of my career, right there. And that was the end of that strike. Not because the women decided that they did not want to continue their legitimate strike. What happened was that the CSN just said, well, if that's the way you want it, there's no more strike fund for you. And since it's a small region, I know three of those women, that was in 1982, I know three of those women that have still to find a permanent job. So it's not just the goons of the Teamsters beating up illegal wildcat strikes in Detroit. This is a common fabric of what unions are and what happens to workers that go a bit outside of the union logic and usual practice. I think I'll leave the more theoretical aspects to our comrade, councilor's comrade here, Neil. And leave time for a two-way discussion a bit later on. Sorry for the English.
Oh, okay, straight in. I think I'm going to be a little less time than Richard. I'll probably be less stirring than Richard, but I'm going to try and have a few more jokes than Richard, so stay tuned. I'd like to, who knows? I wanted to begin with a quote from a book which I read and reviewed a few years ago. It's Buzz Hargrove's sort of autobiography, ghostwritten by a friend of his, I think. Labor of Love, and I'm glad to say that I didn't pay for this, but I think it's a very interesting book, and it's not a good read, but it's revealing. And there's a quote which I wanted to pull to people's attention, because I think I'm actually really surprised he was this honest about it. It says beautifully.
This honest or this honest?
This honest. No, I think he's perfectly honest. He's not, you know, Buzz Hargrove is not a revolutionary. He makes no bones about that. He is, however, known as, he's the president of the Canadian Auto Workers. He has a reputation for being, the CAW has a reputation for militancy, though its backing of provincial liberal politics is cuts into that a little bit. But anyway, Buzz wrote that, he said, unions probably prevent more strikes than they precipitate. Given our adversarial system, where it is often assumed incorrectly that every gain by the worker is a loss for management, it's surprising that there are not more strikes. The fact is that unions are an essential vehicle for lessening the frustration many workers feel. 3 out of 4 workers say they don't trust their employers. Good unions work to diffuse that anger, and they do it effectively. Without unions, there would be anarchy in the workplace. Now, I know some people that sounds like a good thing, but hold on, ladies and gentlemen. There would be anarchy in the workplace. Strikes would be commonplace, and confrontation and violence would increase. Poor quality workmanship, low productivity, increased sick time, absenteeism would be the preferred form of worker protest. By and large, unions deflect these damaging and costly forms of worker resistance. If our critics understood what really goes on behind the labor scenes, they would be thankful that labor leaders are as effective as they are in averting strikes. In my view, the wonder of the collective bargaining process in Canada is that we have so few strikes. Well, that's Buzz for you. That's the militant. I'm going to let that pass. Remember the teachers' union, which, as far as we're involved in the Ontario teachers, it wasn't a strike, because that would be illegal. It was a political action. I'm in OSSDF District 12. That's my card. And I've been a member of the teachers' union for about 5.5 years now. And when I'm a member, because it's a condition of employment. You're a teacher in Ontario, you're a member of the union. And I pay my dues every 2 weeks. It comes right off my pay. I don't give them the money. It comes right off. It's collected for the union by the employer, which should raise, you know, it does raise a few eyebrows as to how that works. This means that the union knows approximately how much its budget's going to be. It gives it some permanence. My union owns a building at Bathurst and St. Clair. It's a 4-story little office building. It's quite nice. It has a full-time staff. I was talking to my rep just yesterday. I assume that he was on part-time salary, but no, he works for the union. He makes what he would make in the classroom. If you look at some of the larger unions, they very closely resemble the companies that they deal with in terms of their corporate structure, the bureaucracy, and the level of power that's concentrated as you get higher and higher into the organization. Once upon a time, though, this wasn't the case. Even as recently as, say, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, which, of course, for all of us young folk, that seems like a long time. But prior to the Second World War, the dues were collected every payday. The shop steward went around, collected the money. You got a little button if you were in, and if you didn't have the button, in some cases you weren't working. But the interesting thing was, if the workers weren't happy with what the union was doing, they didn't pay their dues. They quit. They stopped being union members. So every week or every month, the workers had a referendum on how good their representation was. You see a similar thing like that in France today, where you have 3 or 4 federations sometimes operating in the same workplace, and you say, oh well, CGT's not doing very well, I'm going to go over and see what Force Ouvrière is doing, or maybe I'll go over to the Social Democrats and back and forth. So the unions in France are a little more responsive to their membership than here, but things like the RAND formula, the packages which were set up after World War II, it's a very much controlled system. Now, you can say that's good because it allows the union some strength to defend the workers' rights. Or you can say it's problematic because it separates the union from its workforce. And I think Richard is... I was going to talk about the grievance, but I think Richard covered that, so I'm going to skip some of these points. How did this happen? How did we get to this situation of divorce? Because, the only time I read my contract is when I'm having trouble sleeping. It's about that thick. And I can't read it. A lawyer can't read it. You need a labor lawyer to be able to read these things because they're written in. It's more complicated than the agreement I signed when I bought my house. You know, there's this thick thing and the lawyer just says sign, sign, sign. And your average union contract is like that. It's unreadable. No worker reads their contract because they can't read it. It's not designed for the workers. It's designed for the lawyers, the Lucien Bouchards, and whoever the CAW staff lawyers are. And how do we get to this situation? Unions do come from the working class. There's no question about that. Right? They're products of the class struggle between labor, between workers and capital. There's no denying that, and I don't want to say that's the case. It's not the case. They developed in the 18th, 19th century in Europe, and you know later in other places, primarily as defense organizations. And they were hated by the bosses. You know, you were killed, you were murdered for trying to organize a union. You were deported. The Tolpuddle Martyrs were sent from Britain to Australia just for meeting to talk about forming a union. I think it's ironic, actually, that there's been some talk in Iraq now forming unions and workers' organizations, and the U.S. authority there has said, nope, you can't have a union. You can't have workers' organizations. Why not? Because the Ba'ath Party passed a law in 1987 that said no unions or no workers' organizations in Iraq. So finally they found a law that one of Saddam's laws that they liked. Which I think is a little more than a little amusing. So when Rashaan and I have said that make these points, I don't want to downplay the struggle and the sacrifices that have been made in the past and are made today in many cases. But at the same time as these were defense organizations, they were also organizations that negotiated the purchase of labor power, of the sale and conditions of a better wage, a fair day's pay for a fair day's work was the slogan of the trade unions in the 19th century. Marx wrote a thing or two about labor, so this is a very conservative slogan, and we should actually be arguing for abolition of the wage system. That was the demand that he put forward. But so be it. The thing is, though, that while unions grew up under capitalism as a product of the struggle between capital and workers, they also reflected the same structures. You saw workers organized in one plant against workers organized in a different plant. You saw people, particularly in the late 19th century, you saw the existing craft unions in, say, the American Federation of Labor, the AFL, actively preventing the organization of people they saw as rivals, which they thought would, if we bring these people in, it will lower the price of our labor. We were skilled specialists. So women were not organized. Blacks were not organized. Immigrant workers, Chinese workers. And in fact, if you read the propaganda that was put out by unions in the late 19th century, it was extremely racist against non-white male workers. That we have to keep, you know, the jobs and the skills for our people, and sod you if you're one of these other groups. That's not the case in every situation. There are honorable exceptions. The industrial workers of the world being the best known of this, who had a very different orientation than, say, the American Federation of Labor. The IWW said, we want everybody in. You know, we want to organize immigrant workers, we want to organize the unemployed, doesn't matter what language you speak, where you come from, citizen, what have you. And the other thing that the IWW didn't do is they didn't sign contracts. Now, why the IWW disappeared or was not successful ultimately is a story for another day. Maybe we can talk about that in the discussion period. But revolutionary syndicalism, if you like, was sort of the counterpole to the business unionism, the guild unions. And this identification that I mentioned earlier, identification with the state, has its climax, I think, in World War I, where the unions wholeheartedly supported the slaughter of workers in other countries. Well, our workers in our uniforms will go fight your workers in your uniforms. Same as the socialist parties, for the most part, across Europe, supported this war. Same thing in World War II. The unions helped to organize production for war. They helped. They prevented strikes. Somebody's going to tell me in a minute that many unions opposed the Gulf War. just last year. Well, you know, Soli Kretien. So I don't know what that, you know, that doesn't mean so much. It was easy to oppose that war because it was on such a flimsy basis. Many liberals would get on side with this too. And I think part of this is that we see, if you look at 19th century capitalism, Richard talked about ascendant capitalism. I don't want to get too wrapped up in terminology here, but sometimes we talk about the real and formal domination of capital. In the early days of capitalist production, capitalism was essentially feudalism with a different boss. You, instead of working for the landlord, you went and you worked in the factory. It's not until the beginnings of the 20th century that I think you really see a truly capitalist mode of production, where the worker becomes an appendage to the machine rather than the other way around. In early capitalism, you got a tool, you could be more productive. Now it's the machine, you're working, you're part of the machinery. Marx talks about this in his writings, but it's much greater in later capitalism. In that early period, which I said earlier about the formal rule of capital, I think there is social space. You saw mass workers' parties, you saw workers' co-ops, you saw workers' newspapers. Where's the workers' newspaper in North America? There's millions of workers in North America. Where's our daily newspaper? Jerry Healy notwithstanding. Little sectarian aside there for some of you. These things are gone. The political parties accept capital, accept the rule of capital. There are no mass co-ops. There are small organizations. You know, how many? Look at us. How many people in this room are members of an organization with less than 100 members? Oh, well, let's all raise our hands, right? There's a lot of us here are members of left-wing, socialist, communist organizations. We're very small, we're marginal. And that doesn't mean that we don't have something important to say, but the fact is that the humanist society's got three times the number of people as us. Richard tells me they come from a very bad place. Okay. Couple of things to conclude then. How am I doing for time? I'm going to talk for a few more minutes. Why do social democratic governments fail? Why is the NDP rotten? Why does it always do a bad job when it's elected? I mean, it's a rhetorical question. The NDP is committed to maintaining capitalism. It wants to be a better manager. That's no shock. Howard Hampton is not. People talk about Howard Hampton betraying the working class. Howard Hampton doesn't betray the working class. He's not on my side. He's interested in managing capital. There's no shame. Howard Hampton, for all I know, Buzz Hargrove, may well be nice people. But if he was committed, to doing something different, he would never have been the leader of the party, and he would never have been elected. And I you know, it's not a mystical thing. It's not a conspiracy. But that's the way it works. Richard said this, and I quite agree with it. When the contract is signed, you are guaranteed labor peace for 2 years or 3 years. They talk teachers' contracts next year are going to be 3 years instead of two. And the union ensures that we live up to that. If you walk out, the union is the first one to say, you've got to go back in. You're going to be disciplined. We won't defend you. Unless everybody walks out, and then the union sometimes says, well, okay, if everybody's going out, then maybe we will. But if it's just a few, it's not going to happen. I mean, look at, you know, they talked about the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO in the 1930s. There was just a huge movement against capital. Well, John L. Lewis, the head of the CIO, what's his comment to sell unions to the employers? He says, if you don't want to sit down strike in your factory, sign a contract with us. The best guarantee against a sit down strike is a CIO contract. Now, what does that tell you? Missed the comment there, but okay, we could take that later. Somebody said something. I want to say a few last things. I'm talking too much as usual, but I don't think this is a conspiracy theory. Right? I don't want to say all unions are simply cops. All unions are equally bad and they're always working for the boss. That's obviously not true. You know, usually the guys who are getting their heads broken, who are fighting on the picket lines, they are sometimes the hardest workers for our class. You know? But I have no idea what that is.
Humanists are having
it. It's a chant or something. It's very strange. But, you know, I mean, look at, take three examples of unions. The United Food and Commercial Workers, the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, and the UAW, right? If I had a choice between which one I would join, if I had a choice, the UFCW loses almost every strike. In fact, the new issue of my newsletter, there's an article, just a quick plug here, on the defeat of the supermarket workers' strike in the United States. The IBT, different IBT, will, you know, if you're in opposition there, they're going to kill you. I mean, you know, it's not a good place to be. And the UAW is probably the most honest, the most militant of that. But if you've read the book about the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, Detroit, A Doom on Dying, 1960s, it's the UAW that the League is having trouble with. It's the UAW that the Drum is having trouble with. So it seems to me that nowadays, many times a strike, it used to be a strike was for us, you know, we would strike to fight to win to something, but many people seem to be now, a strike is we strike to see what we're going to give up in this contract, you know, and you end up, even if you're successful, you go on a 6-week strike or 5-week strike, even if you're successful, you get a 5 or 10% raise, which is, you know, next to impossible now, you get a signing bonus. You're paying for your raise by the money you lost when you were on strike. At best, it seems you're standing still. And as Buzz Hargrove once said, you don't need a union to go backwards. Now, I think of unions as the way I think of as the welfare state. I like the welfare state. You know, my son has measles, and I'm glad that I can take my son to a doctor rather than having, you know, die of a simple childhood malady because I don't have the money. You know, people say, oh, if you're against unions or if you're against the welfare capitalism, you must be against... Oh, that's ridiculous. If I can get something, I'll take it. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. If I have a health plan through my job, which I don't, that's a good thing. But it's the same welfare state that evicts tenants. It's the same welfare state that conducts police hunts into welfare fraud and cheats. You know, some people in this room are involved in OCAP, and they can tell you about the welfare state and how evasive or in... What's the word I'm looking for? How sneaky it is. How annoying it can be. We have public schools. Evasive.
Invasive,
thank you. I'm saying evasive. That's the wrong word. Okay. I think the thing is, I think what we come down to at the end of the day, maybe we should take some questions in a minute, is that, you know, under fascism, you have government organizations, you have workers' organizations, they're so-called, and nobody trusts them because they're simply tools of the government. We know that. The other one is that they use the military, they use the army to arrest you, to put you in jail. Democracy is a little better than that. And I'll qualify that in a moment. Fascism is messy. The state coming down on people is messy. It tends to annoy people. It tends to, you know, to create sympathy for those getting squashed. The carrot is usually better than the stick. And I think that the unions operate a lot of that in that way, that they are the carrot for workers rather than the stick. Stick will be used on occasions, but no longer. So my last thing I want to say is, so why do they hate? Why does the employer hate the union so much? Why is their union busting? It's a fair question. If unions are so good for employers, why do they want to get rid of them? Well, at a certain point, unions were opposed because, as I said, they could create trouble. Then when the welfare state system, you have large-scale operations, unions were actually useful because they could institute a certain amount of labor discipline. Now, if you look at the way that production is organized in North America, we're seeing tremendous changes. Sometimes they call it the post-Fordist model, the old Fordist model, the factory system, is changing. A lot of that work is being outsourced and shipped to other places. This decentralization, temp work, and the unions are not so necessary in that situation. So we will see an increase in union busting. And I think for a lot of people, that will tend to make the union stronger. We will stick to those organizations because we see them as some defense against the boss. you know, who knows what that will turn out in the future. But I think I'm going to stop at that point, because somebody's going to ask me what my alternative is in a minute, and I'm going to wait for the question period for that, because it's 8:10 now, and I don't want to take up any more time. So I hope we'll have some discussion. I hope some people will disagree with us, and we can have some back and forth. I see people smiling already. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that what Richard and Neil were getting at is not counterposing being in unions to being unorganized. I think what they pointed to was the historical tendency of the vertical integration of the unions with the modern state. And I think this sort of indicating was around the Second World War, around the dues checkoff, rather than the proletariat lost control of its own organizations. So you would probably want to call it something like the foreign workers' organizations, because that's what they became. Structurally, that's what they became. Now, I don't believe that capitalism can be rewound back to a better time and a better period, where we once again can have the ascending rise of a militant trade union movement. I think that the present day trade union organizations have to be overcome by a more militant working class form. Now, to tell you the truth, it doesn't matter to me if in Shanghai the proletariat forms one big union as their Soviet and utilizes that to smash the state power or to attempt to. It's not the word union that's the problem. It's the industrial union in modern capitalism, I think, that we're going, or that they're addressing more than anything else. Richard, I had a couple of questions for you. First, you said remember when you talked about the ports being blockaded?
Yep.
And the roads? Now, is that completely independent of the unions that happened? Or is it like just union workers on their own going out and doing it?
I'd say it's pretty much a half and half situation. And for example, in the ports, we didn't see any placards from other unions, but on the in the regions, there were many barricades and picket lines where the placards were mixed. So you'd see QFL, CSM, CSQ placards, which, since there was no decision to do something, to the contrary, they were discouraged to do that. So that resembles more of what can happen actually also in smaller towns and working class regions where the apparatus has less of control of the membership.
So the contingents were out, but the officer corps was back over their wine and cigars. The other question is, you said, I don't know whether it was a slip of the tongue, but you said regarding how one relates to present day trade union structures, that if the trade union calls a meeting, then you go to the meeting?
Sure.
Do you think that's always the case? And do you think that from the point of view of how a left communist approaches the trade union movement, that you always go to the meeting that the union bosses call? You have lots of unions where the workers already know that the fucking bosses are rotten, and that you're not going to get anything from sitting in this meeting. It's like half the size of this meeting with the treasurer, the secretary, and Buzz Hargrove sitting there, and lots of guys just say no. But those people are also mobilizable for real class interests, because they already see through the. So I think some workers you're going to maybe bump into if you decide to go and work always in the trade union meetings, but there's a whole other layer of workers. In fact, there's a whole layer of society that's alienated, that knows what the problem is, but just doesn't see an appropriate organizational redress.
Well, to qualify it, you're quite right. What I meant was, if it's an important meeting, like a strike call or something like that, my gauge, I think you say, would be: my fellow workers going? Are they interested? Is there an issue here? Okay, I'll go even a bit farther than that. But we'd be very careful about this. But on the one part, I think it's very important that revolutionaries talk frankly to their fellow workers about where, in all probability, the union is going to, how the union is going to mislead us, and how they're going to try to limit the struggle, limit their expenses, limit their losses as much as possible. As much as I think this is what we need to do in our propaganda. Comrades, this is the struggle. What's going to happen? Should we believe this and this type of intervention? Beware. Beware and count on yourselves to do the job. Don't count on the lawyers. Don't count on the press conferences of the leaders. Count on organizing general assemblies and of your workplace, and if possible, like a situation in Quebec where it's the whole population, coordinate yourselves on a neighborhood level, a regional level, a local level, etc. But in a way, if, for example, I'd be in a factory and a considerable number of my fellow workers came to see me and they said, well, Richard, we're in a delicate situation right now. We've got a union right now representing us, but we're in a crucial situation and we'd like to have people that that we trust more, for example, at such and such a post, a delegate post. People probably think we're ultra-lefts and say that, but in effect, we consider at least in a temporary fashion, perhaps accepting it, but telling our fellow workers under what conditions and what our general critique of the unions are. We would not reject it offhand. Okay, so it's not for us a question of abstentionism.
Would you sign a deal with FAS?
At certain points, where you don't have what we say in French, le rapport de force. The relation of forces, perhaps.
Okay. Well, then you get kind of really tangled, don't you? I mean, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, but I just want to maybe go a bit more in. Like I say, we would consider it, okay? But it would be quite a decision. I'd just like to react a bit more to. Paul. I forgot. Paul's intervention is, I don't think that the resistance to different attacks emerges from the unions. I think they emerge from the class. And sometimes that means that it takes the form of a union reaction. Okay, that's the first thing. And of course they're going to react. Use the word ostensible. That's a very popular. I learned that word actually from your tenants.
It's a good word.
But ostensibly, that's what they're there for. If they don't do it, then what happens is, for example, in Italy, I was able to go to, for example, a May Day in Italy during the Kosovo War. Okay, where the planes the American planes were leaving to do bombing raids 60 miles to the north, and all the CGIL bureaucrats were making their speeches how it's unfortunate, this war is so unfortunate and things like that, but in effect supporting their government. And there was something very strange there. It's that between the mass of workers that was in the great square of the city where we were, and there were masses of workers there, and the speaker, you have this huge plastic, transparent plastic wall. And the reason for that is that when they say foolish things, which is pretty goddamn awful often, is that the workers shoot steel pellets at the bureaucrats. Okay? If the working class and humanity has a future, it's in those fucking steel pellets. I just want to address two things that I didn't do in my expose, is corruption, okay? First, the spectacular corruption, and then the insidious corruption. And again, I'll talk a bit on a personal level, because often so-called ultra-lefts like us, we're told that we don't have any experience of the class struggle and things like that. So Jesus Christ, since we do have a bit of experience, let's talk about it. First off, the spectacular corruption. Right now, the most dynamic, active, how do you call that, venture capitalist in Quebec is the Quebec Federation of Labor Investment Fund. It is. And the government has given it all kinds of facilities in terms of tax rebates, etc., for it to develop. Okay. I'm not going to go on and on about what these so-called workers' investment funds are. I'll just give you the example of the Atlas factory 3 or 4 years ago. It's a t-shirt factory in Montreal, 250 workers, majority women, majority immigrant, especially Latinos. So the QFL, Workers' Investment Fund, buys the factory. And this factory was, the workers in at this factory were already unionized to the QFL at itself. So the contract was over and they decided to renew it. And they decided they were pretty fed up with the $8 an hour, shitty $8 an hour they were getting. So they decided that they wanted more. So the QFL, that was representing them, negotiated with itself. And and surprisingly, it refused to give them a raise. And surprisingly, the union recommended not to go on strike and to accept the offers. And not surprisingly, the workers said, fuck off, and went on strike. Well, nobody talked about it. Not a single extreme left paper in Quebec talked about it. But the QFL shut the goddamn plant down, and those 250 workers were out of the job. That's for the spectacular. Now for the insidious, I'll give you the example of myself. Okay? I was a coordinator for political action for the CSN. At that time, it was 220,000 members. Okay? It's about 250 now. And my tasks were of a provincial nature. I go around almost all the time doing organizing tasks or giving conferences and things like that. And I was a third international type of guy, like our friends here, saying the leadership is rotten, we're going to get rid of the fucking rotten tomatoes, and we're going to make a real working class force out of these structures. I really, like you today, I really believed that for many years. So that's what we were trying to do. At that time, there were 550 full-timers. I was not a full-timer, I was an elected official, and there's hundreds of those at the local, regional, and national level. So they tell me, okay, Richard, you start your tournée of Quebec. So you've got an expense account, okay? And if I'm in Gaspé and I have a breakfast in Gaspé, it costs me $1.75 for my egg and toast, I take a receipt. I give a 25 cents or 35 cents to the waitress, adjust it, and then at the end of the week I take all my receipts, how much it cost me to go to motel, etc., and I bring it to the accountant. So about, and they tell me, you don't need to do that. So every time, and I said, well, I just want to get back the money that I actually spent, you know. So about 3 or 4 months after, they had me come in for an official meeting with the treasurer of the Confederation and the staff. And it says, Comrade Saint-Pierre, there's 550 full-timers here. There's all kinds of hundreds of elected officials that have all kinds of expense account expenses. And everybody asks for the maximum. You're the only person that brings the actual receipts of what it costs you, okay? And it costs us more money to treat your demand for less money than if we had just give you the maximum. Well, at that time, the maximum in 1982 was $5 for breakfast, $8 for dinner, $12 or $14 for supper, $15 if I didn't sleep in a motel so I can offer flowers to whoever I slept at place, and it was 48, I think, general speak in terms of motels, depending where I slept. Okay? So I smiled to myself, and I said, well, fuck off, you know, I'm going to continue doing this. I'm a revolutionary. I'm here to do a job. And, of course, at the end of the day, I didn't have as much money to go and have a beer with the other full-timers, but I wasn't there to have beer with them. Anyway, they were not that nice people anyway. So okay. And I do this 1 year, and I do this 2 years, okay? And then gradually I said to myself, well, I'm really stupid because I'm the only person that's hurting myself here. So gradually I started, just like everybody else, to accept the maximum. And I can tell you, I know a person on one provincial negotiating committee in the hospital sector, just with the expenses, don't forget this is CARE money, tax-free money, was able to buy himself a brand new car, okay? So I went on and on like this, and we could talk, or to be examples for hours, but we'll stop, so don't bear with me a few minutes more. And as the secretary of the opposition caucus, I got beat up. I got the door of my motel room in Arvida broken down, woken up in the middle of my sleep. I'm not without courage when I see a person coming on, you know. But when you get shaken up out of your bed in the middle of the night when you're sleeping, there's two or three goons around you asking, "Where's the list? Where's the list of the opponents?" That's something. So after many, and also every time we try to advance something, we isolate ourselves more and more, and we lose more and more. So one evening, after many years of this, I was in my hotel room, I don't know what fucking goddamn village somewhere, and I was asking myself, why the fuck am I staying here? I'm participating in screwing my fellow workers. I'm telling them conscious lies, and this is true. Conscious lies. Like, we're going to support you 150%. Okay? Things like that. And then seeing people lose their jobs or actually shitting in their pants because they've been molested by union goons, etc. And me, the purist, that wouldn't accept the money, when I actually honestly posed myself the question, why am I still doing this? The first thing that came into my head was, I'm doing it for the expense account. It's the first reason. And I think I'm an honest person. I was getting to being as corrupt as all the others. Just a last note on corruption. There's the money corruption, but there's another form of corruption. The union delegate, and there's some good ones, okay? There's some good people. But there's a considerable amount of... let's say you pass 40 years of your life at the same fucking dull job, and you're elected union delegate. Well, essentially that means that 1 day, 2 days a week, depending the place, you get off the job. You don't have to put on your dirty overalls. You go into an office. You think you're important, and you get away from it. And I spoke about the expense account, but this is extremely important. I used to, this person will deny he ever said this to me. President of the CSN is an ex-Maoist called Jacques Letourneau, who's about 34, 35. He's very bright. I used to babysit his child that he called Carla for Karl Marx, okay? Now he's vice president of the Central Labor Council of Montreal, and it's clear that he's going to be the next president. And he's changed completely his radical critique. He's become very quickly the bureaucrat that I almost became. So about a year ago, I meet him on the street, and he looks at me, and he looks a bit on the, he looks on the ground. He's about 6 foot far, but he looks a bit shy, you know. And I'm saying to myself, should I say hello to this fucker? And so I said, well, finally, okay. So I say hello. He says hello, and I says, well, Jack, you gotta tell me, you know, there's no witnesses around here. What the fuck are you doing? Why are you doing this? I know what you read. I know you know every fucking Connecticut song in the songbook. I know when you get drunk, that's what you sing. And you're screwing all of us. And I think you know it. And you look down on to the trottoir, the pavement, the sidewalk. And he says, Richard, I'm gonna tell you, but if you talk about it, I'm going to deny I ever spoke to you. So I don't care, I'm telling you. And you judge if I'm a liar or not. He said, I'm not going back to Charlemagne hospital on the South Shore to change the shitty sheets of the patients anymore. I have a comfortable life. And this was a nice person when he was 20 years old. And this is the insidious corruption of a whole layer of workers that at some point in their life were pretty good guys, pretty good girls. And that's part of the problem. It's a part of the problem. We just cannot say that this part, for example, this level of corruption at every level was not a phenomena of the unions when in 1919 or 1920 or 1921 the Third International talked about their role. It was that. This is a general new factor, at least at this level. There's always, you know, what's his name, Gompers or crooked leaders, but it's at every level, it integrates the workers inside of the apparatus. And at bourgeois, it's a factor of embourgeoisement, gentrification. So that's, again, it's not very theoretical, but I think it's some of the practical problems we're faced with.
Okay, let me say a couple of things then, quickly. I think the problem, the confusion that's sometimes made, or at least from my perspective, is that people talk about the workers' movement and when they talk about the workers' movement, what they mean is the union movement. The two things are not the same, and I agree with Richard's comment that the fight back often comes out of the struggle between workers and capital, not necessarily the union in involving that. And I'll mention that my stories aren't as dramatic as Richard's. I have a much much duller life than his. But 2 years, I work as an adult education teacher in Toronto. And a few years ago, when the Harris government made its educational reforms, they changed the way that adult education is delivered. I work on a contract basis. I get paid by the hour. I get no benefits. I'm still a member of OSSDF. Same. I still pay dues like every other member of OSSDF. But I'm a contract worker within that system. A few years ago, 2 years ago actually, we came in. No, it was last September. September of 2002, we came into work and we found that our class sizes were on average around about 55 students per class. Now, I teach English as a second language. 55 students a class, and I and another chap at the same school where I teach, who used to be a member of the Canadian Party of Labour, which some of you may or may not know, was a Stalinist organization in the 70s, linked with progressive labour in the United States at one point. But he was a good guy, had been active in the teachers. So we went around and we talked with people, and we collected information, and we organized a couple of meetings outside of school. And I got called into the principal's office several times, and they said, "What are you doing? Are you organizing something?" I said, "Who, me?" And some of the people who were upset said, "Let's call in the union, see what the union can do." And I said, "Well, union's not going to do anything, but, you know, all right, you want to do that?" So we organized a meeting, and we had the chief negotiator come down. We had the president of the union come down, Jim McQueen. And Jim said to us, "You should get a real job. You should get a real job. This is, you know, adult ed is, it's ridiculous. We can't do anything about it. You should get a job in as a Form 1 teacher, teaching high school students. This hopeless, we can't do anything about it." But, you know, and they went away, and that was that. And, you know, you think, okay, well, we called in the big guns, and they said nothing. They said, "We can't help you get a real job." You think, okay, they're going to walk over us. But, you know, term two, everybody's classes were smaller. And my class was a lot smaller. So, I don't know, maybe it's a coincidence. Or maybe the management, and, you know, it's funny because it used to be that the principal was in, who could hire and fire you was also in the union. That's not the case any longer. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But our classes were smaller as a result. 2 years later, a year later, the class size is creeping up to 50 plus again. The union still says, "We can't help you. Get a real job." But what I think what made the difference for us is the meeting that we organized where the union president came out. I think all but two teachers were at that. Every single person came out to that. And that's very little we did, very little, but it was enough to give a little bit of a scare. Now, that's pretty minor compared to some of the other stories, but I think it illustrates the point that resistance comes from where conflict comes. In North America, that form will often flow through union channels because of the structure of unions. Unions are integrated into the workplace. But if you want, I think if you want that struggle to be successful, even though I'm sitting with another union member or a non-union member, you're going to have to go beyond those channels. And I think that's some of the things we've been talking about. And to answer Mick's question, I don't think there's anything wrong with talking to people in your workplace. I don't think there's anything wrong with necessarily going to union meetings. I would never run for office. The president of the local at my school said to me, "Hey, why don't you become the president next year?" And I said, "I'd rather be one of the clowns than the ringmaster." Because if I become the president, then I'm going to carry out the same policies as this, as my friend. He's a decent guy, but he's fed into the structure. And I can only fear that if the Trotskyist leadership comes, they may be a little better. You know, I imagine you'll be a little more militant. But basically, you're bound to the same logic. And if you can break it, you'll say differently. Okay, well, you know, we'll take this up afterwards. Pistols at dawn. Pistols at dawn.
You want to go outside? You want to go outside?
Okay, I mean, you know, the point that you made about the fight back against Harris, well, yeah, it wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't have happened in that form. If Buzz and whoever was running Steel didn't want it to happen, you know, and it wouldn't have ended so sadly if they hadn't, for the same reason, you know. I think workplace groups are a good idea. You know, there is an informal network in a workplace, whether it's unionized or not. There are structures of resistance, whether it's unionized or not. Sometimes those are official channels. We can talk about consciousness on another occasion. I don't want to take up any more time. But the last point I will say, just so that people are clear on what I mean, what I mean by this, I can see a situation where, yeah, I would vote in favor of a union being brought into a plan. You know, it's not an entirely negative thing. If I'm a chicken, I work in a chicken plant stripping chicken guts in South Carolina. Half the workforce is illegal immigrants, and I use that word in quotation marks. UFCW comes in and says we'll organize a union, we'll get higher wages. I'm not going to say no to higher wages, even though, yes, I agree with John's point that ultimately we have to go beyond that. But if it can make my conditions a little better, I can see a situation where I would say yes to that. But you've got to realize that once the union is in, that militancy will be sapped away, and the thing will be taken out of your hands. I remember a story of a case in Detroit in the 40s where there was a little plant that made box springs or something. Most of the workers there were women. Three unions came in to try and organize it. UAW, I think Steel, and maybe Teamsters, who knows, came in. Each case it failed. Now if you look at that, ordinarily they voted it down. Each case you would look and you would say, that means the workers are backward. They didn't want the union. But the interesting thing was, if you talk to people, I know I'm running out of time, because a friend of mine, I know this story because the guy's wife worked there. In fact, Marty Glaberman is the story I'm telling you. The thing was, if they knew that if you brought in the union, you might get a little higher wages, but you're going to work a lot harder because of the speed up. You then would be subject to that discipline. Without that, they made a choice. They said lower wages, but we control the work a little better. And maybe that's the choice in when we talk about workplace groups. That's all we can do sometimes. Because right now, we are a minority. We are not in a position to change society. Potentially, yes. Historically, history is on our side, all that kind of stuff. But you've got to call your shots where you see them. That was more than 4 minutes. Thank you. Well, that's all I'm going to say.